The Sustainable Hour.
For a green, clean, sustainable Geelong. The Sustainable Hour.
Good morning, listeners. We like to start off by acknowledging that we're on the land of the Wathaurong people. We pay tribute to the elders past, present and those to come, and we acknowledge the great work that One Fire is doing in Geelong for reconciliation.
And it's a beautiful sky, a blue sky out there. It's getting more than 30 degrees, wonderful summer, and great mood in the studio. We have a lineup. I almost feel like this is Q&A. This is, on ABC, this program Monday night, because we have a lineup of people, and we certainly have some topics to discuss today. Let's begin off with welcoming one of our distinguished guests, who was a guest 200 shows ago. Today is our 202nd show, and Stephanie Asher were a guest in our third show. That was in 2014 in October. How wonderful to have you back.
Gosh,
and
thank
at
you.
That time you were a candidate, you were running for mayor or something like that, and now you are a councillor.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
How does it feel?
It was only your third show back then.
It was, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
You were very professional, Mick. It was great.
Well, thank you. But I have been doing radio before. I must say, I never thought at that time that I would be still in the studio 200 shows down the track. Personally, I can say for myself, the reason I'm here still is because it's been such a great journey. We have met such fantastic people in this city, and running this show every week has been such a wonderful experience of getting to know what's going on in Geelong and seeing all the most innovative, the foremost thinkers that we have in the city and what they're doing, learning about it and everything. It's so engaging. That's the reward that we get out of it by doing the show. So I think you are one of our foremost thinkers in this city, in the sense that I'm surprised when I go back and listen to what you said back then, 4 years ago. Since then, we've had all this discussion about creating a long-term vision for Geelong. And that was a long process which involved 16,000 residents coming with their opinions, and there were meetings, and we talked about it for a whole year in this radio show. Yeah. And it ended up with this so-called clever and creative vision for Geelong, which was then buried in a capsule in front of City Council last year. We're going to hear about your opinion about all that in a second, but I'd just like to make that flashback to when we started, going back to 2014, and what you said about the future and the need for a long-term vision. Back then, before anybody else, certainly not me, really had that overview of what's needed in the city.
One of my big focuses is looking at the long-term view, so the sustainability from a 50 to 100-year vision. I've been a little disappointed in some of the council workshops I've done where they've actually articulated that long-term they see as 10 to 15 years with traffic management and things like that, and I think we need to really get beyond that and have, 150 and 100-year plans, particularly with energy and those sorts of critical fossil fuel-based issues. Jobs in Geelong, I think, is something that it's a very collaborative answer, and there's a lot of people working on it, but there's a lot of conversation and not much rubber on the road, and I think we need to articulate what those future technologies are and really pick the industries that will carry us through to the next 50 years. So focusing on the renewable energy products, the solar panels, the wind turbines and production of those things in Geelong. I've heard you talk about becoming this clean tech capital of Australia, and I think that's a fantastic tagline for us. The role of mayor would be beyond just pushing one particular solution from a jobs or clean tech focus, but I look at Geelong being positioned as the centre for solutions, and that's certainly one of the most critical solutions we could focus on. I think that's really important.
I love that expression you introduced, actually, a word that, why didn't we catch it at the time? A centre for solutions. Geelong as a centre for solutions. Brilliant.
Yeah, well, I'd get a little bit tired of the centres for excellence, I must say, because I think that gets a little bit hackneyed. And when you look around, and I'm not naming any particular organisation, but this is a nationwide thing where people focus on centres of excellence, and quite often it's actually mediocrity, not excellence. I think solutions
but
is
there, isn't there, when we talk business, isn't there a good idea about creating that sort of spirit in a city that we are the hub. This is the place. Mm-hmm. Like with clean tech, I know in Denmark it's been a great success that the government helped getting 20,000 small-scale companies together in one website and in one sort of hub. They call it the clean tech hub of Denmark. So it's supported by government, but it's actually consisting of 20,000, you could almost say, individual businessmen. Because they become a lot stronger when they speak with one voice to the world.
Absolutely. And you look at what's happening out at Federal Mills and Manufacture Geelong, out at Deakin, it's here. Like, there's lots of startups and scale-ups, and all that energy that you're talking about is here.
Mm. So when you hear yourself, how you were talking then, mm-hmm. about a 100-year vision, not yeah. just a 30-year, but a 100-year, what then is your assessment of this clever creative plan that we have now?
30 years is a pretty good start. I think it's probably not, you know, I still think we should, as a country, we should have a 100-year energy plan. I think we need to really start thinking that sort of time scales, just like China does. You know, we need to actually grow up a little bit. But in Geelong, 30 years is a pretty good start. We're going through the council planning process right now, which is informed by the clever and creative vision.
Is it really?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah? Look, it won't necessarily be rigidly constrained by that. But definitely informed by that. And we're all trying to make sure that everything that we structure does talk about what's the work that's already been done, so that we capture what those 16,000 people put their energy and hopes and dreams into, but also making sure all of the councillors are really keen to include the issues and the concerns and the hopes of all the people in our communities, and when we campaigned and during the election process, just to make sure that those feed up into the process as well. So it's what's important is that there's a strategic approach, because at the moment we've got the vision, we're looking at the plan, but in the middle of those two things is the strategy, and that's the bit that I'm really interested in having a bit of an impact
on. We had Sarah Mansfield in the studio on our 200th hour, that was just before Christmas, mm-hmm. and we did ask her about how is it going in council, you know. Mm-hmm. It's all very new, and she said, well, we're just about finding our feet and so on.
Yeah.
I'm, of course, in particular interested to hear how is it going with the 30-year vision, because I had this talk just after Bruce Harwood was announced as he's the new mayor of the city, and he really was not ready to say anything about that he would commit to, that we even had a vision.
I think he has. I think we all have. And that the councillors, we're very united as a group. There's a lot of positive energy. There's no fear of actually questioning things either. It's a pretty robust group, incredibly astute questions. We all ask. I certainly sit there and I'm really impressed by my fellow councillors, and we're being... I think introduced to new people on the executive as well, which is as interesting for them as it is for us, I'm sure. So there are quite a lot of people still finding their feet, but definitely the passion and the energy is there, and everybody's looking to, you know, have a win-win. Mm. I don't think anybody's...
So to turn that question the other way around, what's the biggest challenges for this vision now? Because we love the vision. You know, it was a vision that said a lot about energy and sustainability and all these things that we fight for here in the Sustainable Hour. I have done it over 4 years now in Geelong. And we speak with all these innovative people who are in this space and want to do something but feel that council is stopping them. Again and again, it's council that's like a blockage for planning and all these things. So, like I said, let's turn the question around. What are the obstacles?
Actually making things happen out of it, I think, to get it from that theoretical sort of motherhood statement status into things that actually do happen and people can see happen. And I hear what you're saying, because we get lots of questions from the community as well, but I certainly have experienced that when we feed those questions through to the officers, there is a real commitment to finding answers. There is a little bit of sometimes I don't know how to answer it, and there might be a bit of a fallback on the traditional, let's answer it with a bunch of words instead of really understand the common sense solution. Mm. But there's a really keen openness to changing and going with us with this. I think everybody senses that there is a new era here and that there is things that can happen. So that's probably making it a reality and making it understandable, taking it out of that sort of bureaucratic speak and making it into plain English and actual events and actual occurrences that people can see, right?
I think where Bruce Harwood and I maybe got each other wrong a little bit was because he kept saying that, well, this future plan, 30 years ahead, we have to talk about today, what we need to do today. And I was trying to say, but that future, you know, it defines what we do today. Mm-hmm. It's very much about infrastructure, for instance. Yep. So how we plan our infrastructure now, that is going to define how people then will move around in 20 years.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because these things don't happen overnight, mm-hmm. such as, for instance, the bike path, separated bike path infrastructure.
Yeah.
I know in Denmark this was something that has been worked on for 50 years, that bike paths have been constructed, and now it's a standard in Denmark that whenever you build a road, of course you have a bike path. Yeah. It's just standard.
Yeah, that's right. And that's that strategic approach that we're really
That didn't come from nowhere. That's my point.
Yeah.
That was
that's
planning
right.
over 50 years. And what it means today is that there are more people on their bicycles in Copenhagen when they go to work, when they cycle to school. You know, kids that don't have driver's license, they use their bike because it's safe. because there are separated bike paths everywhere. I mean, not the very small street, but any main street where you need to go, there would be a bike path.
Well, trails and cycling and all those sorts of things are a huge issue, and certainly from the Bellarine perspective, that was one of the things that I was hearing from the community, and that's a really good example of how we have to make sure that we all are understanding exactly what we're talking about. I fed through, I want to understand what the master plan for trails is around Geelong and the Greater Geelong region, knowing that G21 had a regional trails plan in play. And what I got back was the cycling strategy, which talked about on-road and separated bike paths and what you're referring to. And I went back and I said, no, what I'm talking about is actually the connections between the existing trails. So why do I have to put my bikes in the car to drive from Ocean Grove to the Bellarine Rail Trail? So they said, oh, okay, that's a different thing again. So there's a couple of different ways of looking at it, and you've got to make sure that strategically they all knit together. There's no point having fabulous connections through the CBD and separated bike paths if I can't actually get to the start
get
of the trail.
No.
You know, so it is...
Who will use
everything,
it? Exactly.
Yeah, everything has to work in concert. So it is about making those connections between the trails and also thinking segregated bike paths.
And what I learned, and I actually learned that through a Dane who has been consulting the City of Melbourne for over 15 years, Jan Gehl. He's a city planner. He wrote books back in the 60s. He's a bit of a legend in that space. And he came 15 years ago to Melbourne the first time and started talking to them about creating a livable city and that this meant a city for people, not for cars. And he helped City Council in Melbourne to transform, to change the way they think about cycling. So they have created what he talks about as a fishbone. So that you know when you see a dead fish on the beach in the sand, and you have the spine, and then you have all these bones that go out. Imagine that's bike paths. So you have bike paths that lead down to a central one that then leads into the center of the city. Mm. He's talked about creating that for Melbourne, and apparently it's worked. Mm. I think they have gone from having the usual 2%, 3% riding to work every morning to now having 12%. We'll talk more with some bike experts about these figures in a little while to talk about bike infrastructure.
Well, I think it's a really great example of how we're actually trying to find proper solutions that do include everybody, consult with everybody, listen to the people who, obviously everybody's got a voice, and actually make sure that they are heard and addressed properly. So, yeah.
Okay.
So,
Steph, I understand you've written a book recently. Do you want to tell us briefly about that?
I have. Nice little plug segue. Thanks, Tony. yes, I wrote the biography for Susan Alberti, who's the book's entitled The Footy Lady, which was actually my working title, but the publisher liked it so much that they kept it. But she's actually a lot more than just football. She was the main driver behind the AFL Women's becoming so publicly on the radar and funded it from the very beginning. She's also probably Australia's most well-known diabetes, type 1 diabetes philanthropist, and many other things, former vice president of the Western Bulldogs for a number of years, and I think a whole decade on the board of the Bulldogs. So, yes, that book was released November last year, launched by Richard Goiter at Crown Melbourne, so quite an exciting event, and I'm getting great feedback, which is really exciting.
How did you get involved in that?
It's a mutual contact that knew Sue, and I know, and she suggested I approach Sue because Sue had apparently been looking for quite a while for somebody to write a book that hadn't quite, I think she's quite a modest person, so hadn't quite got up the, I don't know, it's not courage, the openness to say, will you write my book? But I put a pitch to her and she agreed. And
terrific.
Yeah, we went from there. We just clicked. Yeah.
So copies in the library?
Copies in the library, copies online, mup.com.au, and bookshops as well. It's all in every good bookshop.
All right.
Terrific. Thanks, Steph. Back to the bike path.
Yeah, so I want to open that bike path infrastructure discussion now. We have two distinguished guests in the studio now, and they sort of represent two different voices in our city and speak for different groups of our residents, our citizens. So welcome in the studio. First to you, Vince.
Yeah, welcome.
Vince,
thank you.
Albanese?
That's right.
And you represent people who live in and around High Street in Belmont.
Yeah.
And that's where this poster is hanging in the streets or in the windows, the shop windows, where it says, hands off High Street, Daniel Andrews. No bike lanes. Sign the petition. That means there's a petition running against the planning that there is now, that there should be a bike path in High Street. Is that right?
Yeah. Look, that's the petition is basically insurance that... what we promised and what's told to us is going to eventuate.
And what's that?
When we first got mail from the about the bike lanes, it had very much a feel of the old administrative council, because I've had a lot to do with the councils of Geelong, and they've always been, especially when Bruce has been, they've always been consultative, keep you informed, open line of communication. And this just didn't have the same feel about it. It had just a feel of railroadness. We knew nothing about it. As far as we were concerned, we were going to lose all the parking, and then the second line of parking that people want, they get filled up very quickly, and you're going to end up losing. I'm sure a lot of businesses would close as a result of that. Has it turned out, and this is coming, my position is coming not from my own head, it's coming from hundreds of people that I've spoken to since then. They come to me, traders, right along, traders as far as down into the city as well, actually. And the fear with the bike lane isn't, most of us, nearly 95% of us are not anti-bike, we're not. I welcome bike lanes, but what we don't welcome is to lose all the parking instead, because you got to realise, I rode to work for 6 months once, and you know what stopped me? It wasn't the hills, although they were hard to get up. It was the fact that I was sweating like a pig by the time I got to work. I ain't got no shower at work. My father rode to work for 2 years, 20 kilometres he used to ride to work. And what stopped him was losing the family time towards the end, because he had 6 kids. So you got to realise, when these plans are devised, it's you know, done by various government organisations, they're probably all going to have showers in there, but we haven't got showers. Now, since then, we've been told, and this is, Bruce has told me directly, yes, the bike lanes will 100% go down High Street, but we'll be consulted, and more than likely what will happen, we'll have bike lanes plus the parking. And that's probably alleviated 99% of our fears. The other fear, of course, is how it's done. If it's done daytime with 4, 5, 6 big trucks out the front, we're going to lose probably 50% of our turnover, because that's what happens. I've had a lot of experience of this, and businesses will go to the wall. But I don't think that'll happen, because when High Street got done 2003, 2004, at the time I was a business association president, Michael Crutchfield and then Bruce were sort of heavily involved, and they were very consultative. We did it in little sections. We actually did it in the daytime, just about one shop front at a time, and it worked brilliantly because communication from council to the traders and thus to residents, because a lot of residents get the information, always coming to us get the information. It worked really well. But you can see where I'm coming from. It didn't work when we thought, what the world is this? You know, actually we knew nothing about it.
So it was also about the process, the way it was sort of, the letter was sent to you and it sort of opposed you, that you hadn't been asked.
Yeah, well look, if you read the letter, and I've got to admit, to this day, I'll scan through bits of it, but it's not worth probably the paper it's printed on. Because it's got this massive 2 metre bike lane going both ways. That's what it shows. So why wouldn't you believe that's what's coming in? Hello. If that's not what it is, then don't put it on the letter.
But let me just hear so I understand your feeling about bike paths. Like,
yes.
Just recently, there was a green bike path introduced down in Mallop Street, which is a very busy, probably one of the busiest business streets, you know, with trading and all that happening. It's not even ready yet. But what do you think about that? Because I went down there with my kids the other day, and you know what? They thought it looked great.
Yeah.
They actually thought it was a beautifying of that street.
Oh, yeah, it looks good.
Not even talking about cycling, but just the beauty of the street.
Yeah.
Don't you think that brings more people in and actually could enhance trading?
Look, I was actually in the city for a few days last week, and going down Yarra Street into the bike lane, it looks beautiful. I reckon you won't get many over 60s using the Yarra Street bike path for a simple reason. It's snakes and ladders. It is so complicated. You've got drawing all over the road. It just, my God, I mean, I can handle it, but it would keep you away. Where I reckon you've got connecting bike paths that are just so different everywhere, it's too difficult.
Yeah, that's exactly what Stephanie was saying earlier. So that's a connection issue, but just talking specifically do you actually like the look of it?
Yes, I look at it. If I had my way, and this is after speaking with Bruce, my 100% way would be, yes, put 2 green bike paths down both sides of High Street, probably next to the footpath would be better than the parking.
Exactly.
Than the parking.
Exactly.
Now, if a lot of highway users of our street don't come anymore, well, bad luck. I don't want them in there.
Yeah.
Because if the too long Belmont's been used has, I've gone past your shop for 15 years and I didn't know you existed, yet you drove past me for 15 years, and that's a real reality. And none of the traders like that, actually.
No.
Studies from overseas place, and even in Australia where they've done Brisbane, they find that the traders have benefited from it. because the people stop at the coffee shops, buy clothes, whatever, along the way, because they appreciate not having to compete with the traffic.
Yeah, well, I know there's, this is, I don't know if this is true, but where Tony's Bistro used to be in High Street, just up the hill, well, we've been told, it's just rumour, but that there's a education group going there, and there's going to be between 150 and 200 staff there, and they've been told that they're not allowed to drive their car to work. Well, they can drive their car, but they can't park it in any of the parks, because you can see what a problem that would cause. Yes. That'll just break businesses. So they're more than likely going to have to ride to work or get a lift. So I can see it working. I can see it working yeah. well that way. I actually think green in the street will look beautiful. I'm actually in favour of it.
I'm happy to hear that.
You know, last week we talked to a person from BikeSafe, and he said there will be 5,000 students in Deakin in the centre of city, and there's room for 700 cars. You know, so something's got to be done to get 5,000 people in there when you have room for 700 cars. Otherwise, it's chaos.
In Deakin?
Yeah, Deakin.
Where they've got all that land.
Well,
the waterfront IK, yes.
This is what we heard.
I was thinking of the one down near Wampong.
Okay, but that's good. That's that makes me feel better. But what about that petition then? Are you saying that that's not really
good? Well, you know, the real petition is we feel that the way of the state government is to not consult businesses and just go along, do what they want to do, wave to us. Because I've been in the area 18, 19 years. I was president of the business association for nearly 10 years. I've had a lot to do with both sides of politics. The Geelong Council's always given us a lot of their time, bar where the administration was in. And I've got to admit, a couple of left politicians have been good and communicated. Michael Crossfield was one. But for the majority, they just don't ever tell us anything, don't consult with us. They treat us like the enemy.
Mm.
And I'm open to all sides to listen.
Yeah, it shouldn't be about politics in a way.
They just don't come near you. And that's what annoys you. So you can see he's got the hallmark of screw them. They're probably all more from the right, so we'll just go past them.
Oh, that's
and that's what it feels like.
That's annoying in a way. Yeah, I totally
understand
annoying. You. Yeah.
And we look, Sean from Baker's Light Next Door is a member of a bike group and a keen cyclist, and he knew nothing about it. You know, so although there was probably some consulting, it probably was to two or three people near the top, and, you know, it wasn't any great consultation, I'd imagine.
Someone who I'm sure if we ask would say that he's definitely for bike paths and for 2 meter wide bike paths, if possible, down through High Street, is the chairman, I think he's the chairman from
President
it's called, from Bicycle Users Geelong, Tony Gogorovic.
Yeah.
I see you very often on a bike out there on the roads.
Every day,
yeah.
Of course, commuting into town from Geelong's west in Hamlin Heights the last 7 years, I think.
So how have you followed this particular case here? Have you seen the posters and the petition, and what did you think?
I have seen the poster, I guess, and petition. It's been a bit around. Of course, there's been a bit of media about it. So it's doesn't feel that great, of course, as a bike advocate, of course, who works really hard. To want to get authorities to connect us up, so enable bike riding and make it safer for us to ride our bikes to work and around and about, for sure.
So now you've heard some different perspectives in a way than what you read in the media, right here from Vince when he's talking.
Yeah, of course.
It sounds
a
very different thing than when you hear Geelong advertising.
Well, of course, yeah. I mean, you know, you have to...
Or what do you think?
Certainly, yes, of course, you know, a change in the street, in Vince's case for High Street, you know, obviously has some risk for him. As a business owner and an advocate for businesses, of course, so changes can disrupt the status quo. And, of course, if business is good, you don't want to necessarily disrupt that. I completely understand that and understanding that, sheer volume of traffic and the parking issues are already there means that, of course, we need to get more people in there that aren't using cars, aren't driving around, of course, and, alleviate that parking issue with alternative transport, of course, and cities getting denser and busier have only one way to go, of course, in that respect, and assigning more of that space there for, different modes of transport. And, of course, the bikes are a perfect one for cities.
Before listening to Vince before, I was thinking that they were against the bike path completely, but it's not. And it's sort of, you drill down, it's more the way it was communicated to you? It was a letter and yeah. that it's going to be like this and you've got no say in it kind of thing?
Yeah, we're very much against that. Like Geelong Trouble, they've got about 15 staff. And I walked in there Monday morning at 9:30 and nearly fell over when I seen 15 retired people all trying to book holidays, and they're like that all day. It's staggering the amount of business they do now. That's right on the corner. Once the High Street parking, if that had gone, Regent Street would always be full. And he would lose a ton of business and employment. You can see it happening. I've been around long enough to know people want, when it comes to a High Street, the thing they like about High Street is that people are lazy and they want to park just about in your front counter. Yeah. If they have to park, they consider across the road, oh, that's too far. Although when they go to a centre, they're probably three times further than that from the shop they're going to. Yeah.
That might be an opportunity, though, for a bike taxi to get up the hill.
Yeah, well.
It's a way of thinking. We've got really got to get away from being the car culture. Well, and there may be other opportunities for... to overcome that problem, if it's a problem.
Of course, there's heaps of parking that's not on the street. I mean, most of it's off the street there. You know, whether it's Kmart, huge what area, Aldi, Coles, the Belmont Library, behind Tasman Meats, you know, next to my favourite Singapore Noodles there, the noodle, noodle canteen there. There's plenty away from that street, of course. So they're full already. Of course, those people walking that distance already, and it's of course we can be a little bit lazy at times when the option's there. But of course, I don't think that's personally a big issue for people. A certain distance from a shop.
You have got our area's got a high volume of retired people, and the next stage after retired people, 80s and 90 year olds. There's a hell of a lot of homes nearby, and even a 100-metre walk for them, they can't do it. They're the sort of customer that have got to pull up really close. They're like the customer, if they got a car, they'll be using the handicap space, and they need it to be close. You wouldn't believe how much business you lose if they weren't available. The other issue is, behind Aldi's, about 10-odd years ago, Bruce came and he said, we've got some land available for $500,000 behind Aldi's. Traders will have to contribute some $400,000 in a special levy. And you guys, it's hard to get special levies in, but you might have to face that. I signed off and said, yep, we'll accept that. Copped a bit of a caning. We only finished paying for that 2 years ago, $400,000. In the end, $200,000 came from the state Liberal government, contributed towards us. Our contribution was $200,000. But that came from the mum and dad businesses. Really couldn't afford it, but we had to have it. And that's the other part of it. They're upset that you just finished paying for it and it was going to be removed. Mm. You know, that became an issue as well.
So were they paying for on-street parking? Or
There's land behind Aldi. Okay, I think it's ironical because I counted up 70 parks and I assessed to be 70 parks that we might lose. How ironical is that? Exactly what you gained, and we paid for that. You know, the other aspect I reckon that people miss with High Street, talking to Stephen Wells on Saturday, where would Geelong Football Club have been without Alex Popescu, Frank Costa, Rex Gorrell? Like, my landlord, for instance, is a very wealthy man and has a lot of development around Geelong. I barely know him, but I know he's got a lot of development. Do you really want to not have people like that in your local town? When Frank Lowy, whatever he wants, he'll get it just about anywhere, but he ain't going to give a rat's about the local school raffle or about an orphanage down here. He cares about the soccer in Westfield. So that's the other thing. It feels like we're hammering true Geelong-owned businesses. You go to Westfield Moore and Ponds, maybe nice centres, but they're not owned by anyone in Geelong. The business is not owned by most Geelong people. So I just think you've got to be careful that you don't lose that sort of person in town.
I'm absolutely convinced that, of course, enhancing the street, particularly in High Street, of course, the project's bigger than High Street, and it's about transport as well, moving people, not just the shops on High Street, of course, but improving that street, whether it's trees and bike lanes, make it... getting rid of those cars that are kind of using it as a thoroughfare, a car sewer, is a real, it's going to enhance business. Mm. People wanting to go there, they're actually, it's going to trump places like Packing Street for desirability if it's like that. But of course, if it's a punt road in Richmond, really busy thoroughfare, and of course, there's a chance, every year there's more people driving to work. Because, of course, our transport system is about cars, moving them around. Yeah. Predominantly, it's one-dimensional. Yeah. There's a real chance that, it could be a great thing for those traders.
I can see your point, Vince, when we talk about people in the age of 80 and 90. We're never going to get them up on a bicycle, definitely.
No.
But there's also a new generation coming in. And I'm sure some of them also live in Belmont. And wouldn't it be nice if we saw this as a bigger package, where it was not just bike paths, but it was about creating a more livable street with trees and some people on bikes, others parking their cars, that's fine. But that sort of life that it creates, because this is where I'm coming from with bikes. I think they're a completely logical way to get around, because especially for short distances, if I only live, let's say, 200 meter away from a shop, it's just where I'm thinking, I might go tomorrow. But if I have a bike, I'll just jump up on the bike and go. And the other thing is, very often cyclists are more loyal to the shops in their near neighborhood. They actually go there more often because it's actually easier. Mm. It's practical.
Yeah. 10% of Geelong's trips are under 1 kilometre. So people are driving, 900 metres around the corner. Of course, some of that's because, you can't get from Geelong West across Latrobe Terrace to town. And some people are going, I can't walk really easily
and then
around sort of places.
So the
can't cross roads.
Especially, again, for the young people. My son was in Q&A asking the question to the health minister, if you really want a healthy youth, why is it then that you don't promote bike paths more? Because getting kids up because they feel safe on the roads will actually also get them healthier. Obesity, we talked about last week as well, is a big problem in this country. And let's start with the young people who are totally natural cyclists because they don't have a driver's license.
Yeah.
What do you say, Vince?
Yeah, look, I agree with that. I'd like to see young people ride to their destinations a lot more. I mean, it was pretty common when I was a kid. Bike lanes at school were massive. Every second, this is talking about Colac, of course. I think that also leads into what Stephanie was saying before about a long-term future, where you make the bike tracks easy to use and not look like snakes and ladders. Because in Colac, where I come from, it was very easy to ride a bike.
Hmm.
And it worked well. But these days, probably kids riding to school is probably, I'd imagine it's probably a hell of a lot lower than what it was when I was a child.
It certainly is lowest, I think, ever. And of course, ferrying in the car is, I think it's across Victoria, Australia, is now, more than buses and bikes and walking combined across Australia. So, certainly in past days at Geelong, it was easy to ride a bike. I used to ride a bike to school as well. And because there was, of course, 30,000 less cars on the road, 70,000, who knows? A lot less cars on the road. There wasn't a contested space back then. There was space for everybody. The roads were really wide and you could, go around people. It was really easy. Of course, that's not the case anymore. And, of course, vehicles being the dominant, mode of transport and also, the ability to dominate and space have kind of meant that, bike riders, we'll just put your helmet down and back in the car, in the back of the car, kids off to school. And, of course, it's much worse.
But you know what, guys? What I really like now is that we are in a conversation. We're having a positive conversation about the future of the city. We're not yelling at each other and we're not running petitions against each other. We're actually in a conversation.
There's still time for that.
Yeah, the petitions still go.
That's probably the most impressive thing about the whole situation today is that the myths have been dispelled. So you don't believe what you read, for a start. The benefits of actually having a conversation and the importance of communication. I mean, the thing that's obviously upset Vince and some of the other traders is the way that it was communicated. If it was, and Bruce has obviously resolved that by having conversations with you. So, yeah, very important.
Yeah, we often say to guests when they come on, it's like being in a lounge room. But just one point that was covered there. I think what's necessary is a little bit of a halt on this and not just view this as a bike path issue. Why don't we look at Belmont as a small cross-section of Geelong and say, let's make Belmont a more livable city and go back a step and put up. There's a need for other things here. I think this bike path thing, fortunately, has raised a very good issue that we need to look at this greater strategic plan. Yes, those bike networks were done something like 4 years ago. I'm not sure how many people were aware of that.
We were, of course,
Steph was already hit a problem with what the question she was asking. The answer she got back from the officers wasn't what she was chasing. She's fortunately has the resources to be able to fix that. So I think there's a need to have another look and say we can look at Belmont as being a livable city within a very nice city.
Of course, the Priority Bicycle Network was thrashed out quite a few years ago, as I guess Rusty alluded to. There, of course, we were involved in that, put our hand up and went along to sort of, you know, to draw the lines on a map really about, you know, really where, you know, we can, where people need to go. And, of course, it's around hubs and nodes of activity. Of course, High Street's one of those big ones. You know, it could, you know, could be, you know, the centre of town, of course, around schools, universities, shopping centres, of course. And, you know, Vic Roads, of course, involved, G21 involved, other councils. Of course, this is something that's already happened at, you know, across the state and other councils, mostly in Melbourne. But, of course, you know, with a view to transport and how people move around in the future going forward and how, of course, bike riding can enable more people to move around cities more efficiently as they do when they're out of cars. Because, of course, you know, stuck in traffic, there's nothing nice about that. And that's in our future, of course, because what we build right now is car-centric still, state government down and kind of locally. But this is an opportunity, a great opportunity, really, for changing the dynamic on a pretty hideous street. You know, not just, I mean, of course, High Street, but Moorabool Street, Jerringhap Street, really treacherous places to go. I mean, there's not enough Prozac in the world to make you feel good about riding up and down High Street at a busy time of day. It's really, really stressful. People come off their bikes, they get doored. They end up not riding. They get in the car. And they use up those car parks, really.
To get doored. And I haven't heard that expression.
Yeah, it's delightful. I'm lucky enough I've missed quite a few of those.
They're deadly.
Oh, yeah. I know quite a few people have, you know, riders who have come off being doored. You know, people I work with, people I could talk to as part of this bicycle user group. People come to me going, Tony, can you fix these? And I said, of course I can't. It's up to the authorities, really, to drive that, but we can sort of pest them to death.
I think it's really important to make sure that the conversation doesn't just talk about transport, because when you're only talking about transport, people straight away think about freight and trains and trucks and roads, and they don't actually think about connections and public. And even when you talk about public transport, they're straight away thinking vehicles. So active transport is one term, sustainable transport's another one, but I really like the idea of transport and connections, because as you're saying, when you actually connect people to where their destination is and how they get there, then you do create a livability thing. So it's more than just the physical connection, it's actually the emotional connection as well. So you create a different vibe when you have different transport options, and it's bigger than transport, because transport to me is just too vehicular somehow, and it limits the discussion.
That was Stephanie Asher, who we have in the studio. She's a counsellor, and she will be listening to your opinion out there. Everyone has the chance until next Friday, is it? There's this call for submissions.
Yep.
And that's not even, you know, it doesn't have to be like you're sitting and writing a long academic piece about cycling and so on. It's actually just 10 questions asking you, what do you think?
Mm-hmm.
And it takes, what, 5-10 minutes to go through if you want to be quick?
Yep, on the website.
Can you tell us a little bit about what's the next process?
Well, you
are you going? Councillors going to be making a decision on this at a point or what?
There's actually, well, first of all, finding out more and providing feedback. It's open. There's a workshop on Monday, on the 12th of February, from 5:45 till 6:45 at the Belmont Library.
Are you sure it's Monday? Because I have the information it's on Tuesday.
No, Tuesday's the traders' workshop.
Ah, there's, okay.
So, yeah, there's the traders are a big good part of this, so it's residents and traders. And that, I mean, that's a really good point, and Vince is obviously really involved and giving great feedback, and it is about developing the best possible design for cyclists and the existing users, so the traders. So there's not actually going to be work started on High Street itself until next year, so there's plenty of time to get the design right. So, you know, I think that's a really big part of the message about consultation, because I know, having been a, you know, disgruntled community member before I was on council, that consultation processes, if they've not done right, it's sort of very insulting. I used to call it the insultation process rather than consultation. So, look, I think, you know, the City of Greater Geelong is getting these things right now. So workshop with traders is next Tuesday. And Monday we've got the workshop with community, and you can also go to the website, and it's geelongaustralia.com.au/betterbikeconnections and have your say there as well. Oh, actually, I've got Tuesday and other way around. So Monday's the traders and Tuesday is.
Ah, so I was right. Now we're getting there.
Sorry. Yes. First, I've got two.
No, but that's good. We talk about it because people could get confused. Yeah, but now, because they heard the sustainable hour, then they get it right. Which is so the open one for anybody to step in the library in Belmont is on Tuesday afternoon at 3 o'clock.
Yes, correct. Perfect. Sorry, there's three pieces here. I've got notes all over the place. Very kindly provided by the energetic officers at City of Belmont.
I want to thank all of you for giving us this really exciting insight into the realities of what it means to construct new bike paths in a city and how we can do it in a way where hopefully everybody gets happy. Hmm. Even those who don't use the bike themselves could get happy because there'll be less competition around the parking places if we do it right. And there'll be less congestion in the roads if more people get up on the bikes. That's my point anyway, as a car driver, and I speak as a car driver there.
Yeah.
Speaking of dooring, three kids, and I happen to know them pretty well, were out doing a music video for a song they have done, a rap song, because they definitely are advocates for bike paths. They really want to see some more bike paths in the city. And they have included a dooring incident, a drama, in their video. The video is out on YouTube. Just look for Bike Power on YouTube. And you might have to write Alex, because there's a lot of bike power on YouTube, I found out when I looked for it. But if you write bike power and Alex in YouTube in the search engine there, you will find the video for this song. I think we should hear it. It's just 2 minutes long, and it's certainly energetic. And here's some people who are taking a stand. And I hope also people in Belmont and High Street will listen to that generation, because really, they can't drive their cars, they can't park their cars. So they need their bikes to be able to really move around more independently from their parents, and they need bike paths if it's going to be done safely.
So this track isn't against bike tracks, it's for bike tracks.
Because they can't do it themselves.
Can we start already?
Oh, come on, fine.
Okay, fine.
Wait, it's about to start, guys, be quiet.
Well, hello, Andrew. How's it going? How's the job been? To the stop throwing digital pictures, which is a teen. So, well, how do they say we're contested go? You probably get, we can put up your back. So here we are, this track for bike tracks. If we succeed, you get the first. Look back the back, we got what you like, the fact.
Just so say, 10 die a year from people on bikes getting hit, you hear? Maybe the lack of bike paths is a connection. We're not going stuff,
you deserve a correction.
Let me tell you something.
My bike wasn't fat and saved me money.
Your car was the money and
makes you fat.
Gas from your cars, we're never coming back.
Bike power, you stand up, don't be a coward.
We're never coming back. Opportunity to
the black community.
We're saying unity.
We're trying to make a greater love. If you agree, sing along.
5, 6, 7, 8.
My bike was a fat and saved me money.
Your car was a money and
makes you fat.
Bike power, you stand up, don't be a coward.
This is an opportunity to put a
community.
We're standing in unity.
We're trying to make a greater love. If you agree,
sing along.
The Sustainable Hour.
For a green, clean, sustainable Geelong. The Sustainable Hour.
So one aspect of cycling that we haven't even touched on, and that's really unlike us, we haven't even mentioned the word yet, Tony, the word. What's the word?
Climate change.
There is, of course, that aspect that bikes don't emit fossil fuels and whatever we call it. Tony, you have some news there in that space?
Yeah, well, we've got Thea Omorod from the Australian Religious Response to Climate Change, and she's running a webinar on the 15th, so tomorrow week. So, Thea, you're on the line there.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about what you're up to.
Yeah, well, Thursday week we're going to have a webinar at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, so people can tune in from their own home or office. It is especially targeted at Catholic organisations, but it will be talking about how two organisations are currently divesting from fossil fuels as a response to climate change. And there'll be an expert financial advisor who advises on divestment from fossil fuels, you know, as her 9-to-5 job. So she's very familiar with all the ins and outs in the Australian context.
So it's designed, there'll be the people that take part in the webinar, there'll be models for them to follow, so there'll
yes.
be no reinventing the wheel necessary.
What are people doing? So each organisation has its own way of managing its finances, and we can agree pretty easily that we don't want to be supporting polluting industries in the way we invest. So, you know, behind the scenes, we all have accounts and funds and super funds, and we can do this as individuals too. That is, take our money away from where it's being invested in, you know, mining, and particularly mining and extractive industries, but also heavily polluting industries like coal-fired power stations. So this will be a webinar in how you go about doing that.
Sia, can I ask you that question? How are we doing when it comes to, for instance, the Catholics? Because 2 years ago, the Pope in Rome, Pope Francis, wrote this encyclical letter. It was 180 pages where he really stressed that if we want to protect life on this planet, we need to do things very radically different. And he talked about how corrupt governments are. He said so many things mm-hmm. that I was thought, this is a revolutionary paper. Mm-hmm. It's going to change everything. And now we're 2 years down the track, and I'm wondering, what's going on? Where are the Catholics? Why am I not hearing anything? Where are the Catholic politicians standing up for the encyclical, and so on and so on and so on. So what's your impression? How is it going with the Catholics, speaking of that?
I don't know why Catholic politicians aren't getting on board with this. And it really is hugely frustrating for any of us who are, you know, thinking Catholics, that we have, you know, politicians who are not only not implementing this, but actively working against anyone who is trying to protect the environment actively. So it's very frustrating. Anyway, among the ordinary rank-and-file Catholics, one of the bad things we're at is publicising things like Laudato Si. So among rank-and-file Catholics, only about half have actually even heard of it. So, yeah, we're not great on getting that message out there. However, there are lots of Catholic organisations who are divesting from fossil fuels. And in Australia, we kind of internationally took the lead in Catholic organisations divesting. And it was after we publicised Catholic divestment in Australia that a whole lot of Catholic organisations around the world began to more actively divest from fossil fuels. So, yeah, we've got, like, the good, but the bad and the ugly in Australia, I think.
We sure do. Now, why is this a religious or a faith issue? Why is climate change? How did you come to get involved in this?
Because, you know, you can't say you love God and then trash creation, which God made, you know, or just use it and exploit it. Like it's just something. So partly it's about a personal experience of really finding a lot of spiritual nourishment in enjoying creation, like a lot of people who aren't theists. You know, but then I make that connection. That is about my faith in God. And taking responsibility towards people who are less fortunate than ourselves is not a long step from that to looking after the environment, because the people who suffer the most when the environment is damaged are people who are poor, you know, people in low-lying islands in Bangladesh, people who are in Africa who are quickly suffering drought, and, you know, not only do they suffer these things, but they've got no buffer zone. They've got no easy way of adapting. So it's caring for the poor and vulnerable on the earth that makes you more motivated to do something about the climate.
Terrific, Theo. We're going to have to leave it there now. We're just about out of time. But thanks for your time today. I know you're busy. And all the best with the webinar next on Thursday.
Yeah, and the way to register for the webinar is to go to www.arrrc.org.au and the events column, and just you can RSVP formally via the link that's there. So arc.org.au.
Okay, we'll put that on the podcast anyway. So yeah, thanks for that, Thea.
Thank you
very much. This was a great ending of our show today, getting that sort of the biggest dimension of them all, in a way, into the program just as well. Thank you very much, and we'll keep asking you more questions, Thea.
Yes, thanks. Okay.
Beautiful.
Have a good week. Yep.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot, Thea. Bye.
That's all we could fit in the Sustainable Hour.
Just one more point before we go. I want to inform people that there really is two bike path issues. There's one from the west and there's one from the south. It's just the south is getting all the publicity.
So that's another discussion.
We've got to get out of here.
Yes. Anyway, as we say always in the end, this is important for each and every one of us to
be the change.
Thanks, Tony.
And thanks you to Stephanie.
And thanks to Vince.
You want a new definition of hardcore? Check out the Intergovernmental Climate Report. It says the world is getting warmer, unequivocally, and the oceans have increased 30% in acidity, and 90% of the warming trend is oceanic and concentrated in the Arctic. Nobody panic, but the level of greenhouse gases in the air is higher now than it's been in millions of years. We added more than a trillion tons of CO2 to the atmosphere. It's gonna be centuries before some of the gas is clear. I'm dropping science, unvarnished, unbiased, but I don't blame you if your instinct is to deny it, cause we evolved to prioritize immediate threats. If it bleeds, it leads, that's what the media says. So let the gangster-esque rap music paint a picture, and I'll hit you with some evidence-based predictions. Get ready for wars, famines, droughts, floods, hurricanes, heat waves, murders, thugs, chaos, refugees, stress, disease, extinction, disaster, IPCC. Wars, famines, Hollywood summer blockbusters can't touch this. I get my thrills from the latest reports published by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, formed in 1988 to get the science straight. Now they dropped the fifth assessment and the data's up to date, so allow me to summarize. Bad things on the way, higher emissions, sea level rise, dire predictions on target for disaster movie style predicaments. In Copenhagen we set a limit of 2 degrees, but that's still enough to disintegrate major ice sheets over the course of centuries, or maybe decades. Yeah, some of the details are still up for debate. They fluctuate between certain disaster and likely disaster, slow and steady or higher and faster. Consensus, it's the lowest common denominator, which means it's probably gonna be way worse than the wars, famines, droughts, floods, hurricanes, heat waves, murders, thugs, chaos, refugees, stress, disease, extinction, disaster, IPCC. Wars, famines, droughts, floods, hurricanes, heat waves, murders, thugs, chaos, refugees, stress, disease, extinction, disaster, IPCC. So be afraid, be very afraid, but we're not, despite what the scenarios say. And the effect of talking about it is visible yawning, and occasionally changing our behavior microscopically. And even those who get it tend to get it logically, but not viscerally. So we're navigating myopically. The threat is existential, it's not environmental, and your individual response is inconsequential. Only coordination of our whole species is gonna keep coastal cities from sinking below the deep seas. And when was the last time a solution included all of us? Geophysics is at the mercy of geopolitics. Climate change communicators, keep it positive. People need to feel like they still have options, and we do have options. Either we find a solution or we stick with the business as usual level pollution and get used to the wars, famines, droughts, floods, hurricanes, heat waves,